Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the There's Classified and Then There's Classified Classified Edition. I am not Shane Harris of the Daily Beast.
It's a pretty good sub, though.
Yeah.
Do I really sound like that?
Well, the hello is really the same.
Would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
No, that's okay.
You want to be anonymous,
You should introduce
Liz.
Liz,
you have to... No, you were listening last week, everybody. This is Ms. Tom.
Okay.
Yes, of Brookings and Lawfare.
Research extraordinaire and Shane Harris.
And apparently my vocal doppelganger.
Okay, introduce myself as Shane Harris's vocal doppelganger.
There you go.
If you listened last week, Ben insisted that now whenever he hears Liz say hello in the hallway, he thinks of me because it sounds like how I introduce
I think of, and welcome to Rational Security.
Hello.
There it is. There it
is. Hello and welcome to our
show. There it is.
Hello and welcome to the show.
It's good. Every time we need a little Shane hit, we just walk around the corner.
And just go see Liz.
Yeah, the vocal doppelganger.
Nice. Exactly. I like that.
We should get her a vocal doppelganger shirt.
Liz, you should put this on your LinkedIn profile. Your
right.
The vocal doppelganger of Shane Harris of the Daily.
Actually, whenever I lived in Italy, there were people who, like, their whole job was being, like, Tom Cruise's voice for, like, Italian films.
Oh, yeah.
There's, like, one actor that's, like, the Italian
Tom
Cruise.
This is right, yeah.
Anyway, Shane, like, I mean, of all the people in this room, Shane is most likely to be the person portrayed in a film.
Right,
so you could have a real career.
Yeah.
This would be good. You could be me, like, in Norway.
That would be so exciting.
You know, like, but
except then
on.
You'd have to speak Norwegian.
Do you speak any
no, Spanish.
Oh, that's even better. I lived in Spain for a while. Hola, yo soy Shane.
Bienvenidos a National Security.
Seguridad Nacional. Excellent. We should totally get translated in Arabic.
It'd be so fun.
Liz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. This
and
has
for,
been
and
fun.
And for standing in for me in such good stead.
And next week, Liz will take over the show entirely.
Yeah, right. Next
like
week,
the world.
With Liz.
Bye, Liz.
Bye.
Thanks, Liz. So now it's just the three of us. Tamara Kaufman Wittes is away this week. I'm here with my friends, Ben Wittes. Hello, Ben.
Hi.
And Susan Hennessy.
Hi, hello, Shane. Susan.
Maybe,
hello.
Maybe you should say hello.
Hello.
Hello, wow. Shane.
That's I was prepared to be skeptical. It does sound like me.
It does. It
a girl version of me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know,
a lady Shane.
A lady Shane.
Mm-hmm.
Could, you know, yeah, we should, maybe we're like long lost relatives. I doubt that.
Let's launch an investigation.
Okay, let's get that.
But you seem to be related to everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, at least everybody with a military history.
That's true. I am of revolutionary stock, as we've discussed. Right.
I am as well. My grandmother was in the DAR.
Was she?
I think I can like automatically join the DAR
you
if I want.
She was in it, I think. I got to get my sons in the American Revolution application process.
I think you need to join the DAR just as a matter of principle and, you know, then show up and do outrageous things at the DAR to
so you want me to
heads.
Infiltrate the DAR?
Yes. I
mean, I guess not infiltrate. I am a daughter of the American Revolution, and
yes.
So
whether you're a credentialed daughter of the American Revolution.
No, I think you should show up and misbehave at DAR events.
Totally,
I'll take that under advisement, as they say.
This week on the show, a Navy officer is accused of spying, possibly for Taiwan and or China. President Obama wades into the debate over how much government information should be classified, and a family in Kansas is trapped in a special kind of internet hell, different than the usual one that we're all accustomed to. Plus, as always, object lessons. Let's start with this Navy officer. It was announced today that 8 months ago, actually, a Lieutenant Commander Edward Lin, who is a signals intelligence specialist with the Navy, was put in a brig in Chesapeake, Virginia. Last Friday, he was formally charged with multiple counts of espionage and attempted espionage. We did some reporting on this in the Daily Beast. Our sources are telling us that he was spying for Taiwan, not necessarily for China. He is Taiwanese by birth. But kind of had this amazing American success story, emigrated here when he was 14, changed his name to Edward because he said in a speech at his naturalization ceremony, his Chinese Chinese name was too many letters long, no one could pronounce it. He thought that America was going to be like Disneyland, he enrolled in the military, he became a U.S. citizen. It's this really kind of, you know, classic American immigrant story, And
with a twist.
With quite a twist in the end.
It's like more of a The Americans kind of immigrant story.
Right, yeah, that is true. Which, by the way, back on FX, great show. I actually interviewed briefly his sister this week, who was distraught over these charges, said he's completely innocent of them, he would never do something like this. This is potentially, though, a big deal to have a military officer accused of possibly selling secrets. There hasn't been, I don't think, a military officer accused of espionage since, gosh, it's been a while.
Yeah, but
you're not counting the Chelsea Manning case.
But it does happen.
And
sometimes it happens a lot. I remember when I was a teenager, there was the whole Year of the Spy, I think 1985, where, every day you would turn on the television and somebody else would be accused of espionage. The whole Walker spy ring got broken up, and
Walker, that's what
I was thinking, know, and yeah. so I think there's, it is not unheard of for there to be, espionage against the United States from within the military.
The piece I'm really interested in is how they found out.
Yeah.
Right, so certainly post-Manning, certainly post-Snowden, definitely an increasing attention and effort on, quote, the insider threat.
Right.
This notion of it doesn't matter sort of how strongly you you fortify your systems from external parties if you have a mole, essentially,
yeah,
in the building. And so there's been a lot of sort of effort on moving, frankly, back to some of the stovepiping stuff that had been swept away post 9/11, trying to be more thoughtful about access controls, about not just authenticating the identity of the individual, but also making sure each individual was only looking at information they should be looking at. So I will be really interested to know sort of how this activity was discovered, right? So was it through sort of some of the new programs that the Department of mm-hmm. Defense has rolled out to kind of comb for this stuff, catch this stuff, or was it through sort of the ordinary, right, signals intelligence or sort yeah. of activity collecting on this foreign entity? I mean, I won't hold my breath for the Navy to bring that information forward, but that's the one thing that really sort of piqued my interest of, ooh, I wonder how they got it.
Well, one thing, it's sort of along those lines that we're just starting to suss out this week. So apparently what first alerted people to what they thought was suspicious behavior is that he had lied about where he said he was going on a trip while on personal leave, which then begged the question, well, how did they know that he was lying? How'd they find that out? I don't know if they're now tracking flight reservations for military personnel or if they were matching this up. They then went and talked to, I gather, some of his colleagues, said he'd been acting suspiciously, whatever that means. It's still kind of vague.
Where had he actually been going?
Well, that's not clear either, but he was arrested, apparently, while attempting to board a flight in Hawaii bound for mainland China.
Well, so it's not totally surprising that reserving a flight to mainland China will trip some wire.
Right.
Some
Nor
wire
doesn't mean he was flying for China, necessarily.
Right.
But, right. So it could be that any military personnel who suddenly, start booking international travel, I don't know if that gets flagged or...
Well, so you do have a reporting obligation. Anyone who holds an active clearance, you basically have to tell the
right,
government...
Right, because Snowden got in trouble for this. Why didn't he disclose a trip to India?
Exactly. You have to tell the government in advance and essentially seek permission. There's a number of places where you can go and kind of get permission after the fact.
Do you have to ask?
I do. I did. I no longer have to. But I did have to ask first. They did verify the information that I was actually
right.
going where I said I was going. Whenever you join the military and the intelligence community, you provide all kinds of consent for the government to may sort of preserve the integrity of classified information that could in theory, I have no personal knowledge of what the Navy's sort of procedures are, but that could include, checking public records or following up or asking for verification of travel. Interestingly enough, actually, visiting an embassy qualifies as foreign travel. And so
if you were to go to an embassy in Washington?
Yes. And so they always have this really nice, like sort of the dinners at the embassies, you know, do the open house. And we were never allowed to go because there was no way to get permission ahead of time to go to all of these quote foreign countries. And so I never got to go.
Could you stand on the street outside it
and peering in the window? Like lob a Swedish meatball over the fence or something?
With a forlorn expression on your face?
Some binoculars and like a you know, parabolic
maybe a
microphone?
Puppy dog eyes and...
Mm-hmm. Take pity on you with your security clearance.
Yeah.
Another thing that was interesting to me in this was, and obviously there was first a suggestion he may have been spying for China, and that it's not completely sure that he was or wasn't, which obviously would be, you know, worrisome / potentially not that surprising. We know the Chinese are going to great efforts to recruit people inside the United States. There's been a lot of...
God, reporting. It's like they're obsessed with us or something.
It's like they just want to know all our secrets.
God.
What is it with China and secrets?
What is up with them?
The thing I was listening, you know, is that there was the suggestion also to us from sources that, no, it was more likely Taiwan. So why would someone be spying for Taiwan? And what I thought was interesting was, could this be a story of somebody who is... born in Taiwan. He actually had posted some pretty, you know, nasty things about Mao on his Facebook page, which doesn't necessarily mean he's anti-China, but could this be somebody who sort of had kind of, you know, patriotic birth country sort of sympathies and maybe was doing something that he thought was going to benefit the defense of Taiwan vis-a-vis China?
He could have. I mean, like, if we're in sort of the realm of utter speculation, Taiwan and the United States are allies. You know, certainly all sorts of activity in the South China Sea that presumably the Navy might be involved in. You know, he might have viewed himself as,
Jonathan Pollard-like figure, right. You might say.
But passing information that was
no
harm, right, of no harm to the United States and was sort of helping out Taiwan, right? It's sort of, who knows what this was. If it was Taiwan, though, it would be more likely to be something that was, Taiwan sort of trying to suss out American intentions or that sort of information versus, you know, the espionage.
Yeah, I mean, if I were the Chinese intelligence service, and I wanted to target somebody like that, I would probably try to make sure that I passed myself off as Taiwanese, right?
Yeah.
And I wonder if, I wonder if it can be kind of opaque which security services you're dealing with.
This is also a very strange story because it sounds like he was potentially compensated with sexual favors. It was never sort of reported who was providing this compensation. So, I mean, the whole thing is really, the public information is really sort of this bizarre tale.
Well, the great thing about these cases is that they never go to trial. They absolutely always plead out to something.
Yeah.
And in the context of that, you get some significant set of descriptions.
Even under Uniform Code of Military Justice? Because I found that very frustrating this week. Like, there's no docket on this guy. There's a redacted charging sheet, which you can really...
Well, actually, I mean, under the UCMJ, if you're going to plead to something, there's a much more extensive colloquy that happens between you and the military judge than there is in the federal court system.
Oh, really? You gotta kind of bare your soul and come clean?
No, but you have to ask, you have to be asked a whole series of questions, and specifically aver to a whole lot of individual things, whereas in the federal system, you really merely have to attest that you're pleading guilty because you are guilty.
Right.
Whereas in the military system, you have to be kind of walked through a lot of facts before a plea will be accepted.
And notably, this is actually not the only sort of spy case of the week.
Yeah, there's another
one. Ben mentioned cases. A former Energy Department employee has now been sentenced to 18 months in prison.
I think we should go for a hat trick this week.
Exactly.
I think if
somebody
else,
come forward.
If we don't get a third spy case.
They come in three, it's like dead celebrities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So he was sentenced to how long?
18 months in prison. So this is a very strange story. Mm-hmm. This is a former employee of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It sounds like he was fired, and then he offered to sell a foreign government a list of email addresses for DOE employees for $19,000, which strikes me as a very specific amount of money. But
good
sure.
Kind of deal. Right. 25, 18, 19
Deal. And then apparently the FBI caught wind of this offer and then launched a sting investigation by which he sort of agreed to facilitate the sending of these spear phishing emails. Anyway, a very strange story. Again, sort of an interesting twist on how
spies.
He got
old
caught.
Fashioned spies are still in our midst.
Yeah. Humant.
Yeah, humant works, man.
So while we're all focused on this NSA stuff, people are recruiting actual spies.
But interestingly, this is not about classified information, right? This is just about a department of an Energy Department employee selling Energy Department email addresses, which are not classified, which is a fairly good segue.
Which seems like that should also just, by the way, just be something that's covered in your employee handbook, but not a crime. But yes.
Right. Well, but not espionage, yeah. not sort of classified information.
Right. So what is it? What are you charged with if you're selling unclassified Energy Department emails to the benefit of a foreign government for 19 grand.
He pled guilty to one charge of attempting to damage protected government computers.
Oh, well, there you go.
Ah, okay.
Interesting. Yeah.
So he's a spy, but we didn't get him on spying, per se.
Right.
Per se. But this does, as you're right, so you're, Susan, lead into this question of classified information, which is the next thing we're going to talk about. So what is classified? Apparently there's classified, and then there's classified.
And then there's classified.
And of course, then there's really, really, really frickin' classified.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
That's the stuff Susan
right. Double top
with.
Secret.
Exactly. Super dog, mm-hmm. double dog secret. Mm-hmm. But don't take our word for it. This was generally a description offered by the chief classifying authority of the United States government, President Obama.
On Fox News.
On Fox
News. He wears a lot of hats, goodness. He is the chief
guy.
CAO.
Lame
my
duck,
goodness.
Enough. No, sir. So President Obama gave his first interview as president to Fox News Sunday.
Which is, by the way, was a really good interview.
It was an excellent interview.
That's his first interview as president?
As president.
No, with Fox News.
No, yeah. Thank you, Benjamin Lewis. I didn't realize he's never been on Fox News.
No, he's never been on Fox News.
And yeah, he's never been on Fox News Sunday. Chris Wallace has interviewed him in other contexts.
Okay, all right.
But only a couple of times.
Okay.
I think Fox asked questions that other networks wouldn't have asked of him, and they got interesting information.
Yeah, it was a good interview.
It was a really good interview, and I thought Obama was interesting and engaging. And by the way, one of the most interesting things of it is that he expressed the fact that the biggest regret of his presidency was not having a day after plan for Libya.
Okay, well, let's talk about that in a minute. But first, this issue of classification, because the Libya thing and the classification thing both bear directly on Hillary Clinton's campaign for president. So Obama was asked the questions about the investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server, and sort of in the one moment of saying, you know, well, there's an investigation ongoing, then began to opine on the outcome of that investigation, which caused us a bit of a consternation among some people, saying that he was, well, not the outcome, but he said he was confident that she had not violated any national security information, and then went on to sort of make this distinction between, you know, well, there's classified information that's not really classified. It's the kind of stuff that'd be in open source, but it's technically classified.
Classified light.
And then actual classified.
Right.
And making essentially what I think has become the argument of Hillary Clinton and her supporters after it's been determined that some of the information in the emails was classified is that it wasn't as if it was, you know, code word, you know, access programs, the names of agents.
As Petraeus said, code word classified stuff.
Yes, yeah. Not that, but rather the
as
kind
he
of
turned
thing,
it over to his mistress.
Right, yeah. It sounds like sort of discussion about the drone program, which, you know, technically is classified, but as everyone knows, is the worst kept secret. It's a not secret secret. But that was, you know, so there's a political aspect of that, but then there is the President of the United States effectively making, if not explicitly, then implicitly in this argument, that there is just way too much shit that is classified. And that the kind of stuff that you would find on a Secretary of State's email account probably is going to be in that category of stuff that, like, yeah, technically it's classified, but it's not really a secret.
Well, I think two things. One, I think the first step to meaningful transparency reform is meaningful classification reform.
Right.
It isn't, I don't even know that it's an open secret. It's not a secret. It is well known within the intelligence community, within the military, that there's all kinds of stuff that is marked classified, and therefore you are legally obligated to protect and not discuss, that just shouldn't be, right? Because everyone knows it, or because it's not actually a grave harm to national security or a harm to national security. You know, and that because of the incentives of the classification system, you know, the sort of, even though the explicit rules say when in doubt underclassify, right, it sort of, it specifically says that, all of the incentive structures is don't make a mistake, right? And so the classification authority is always going to go for the higher level of classification. This is, one, a real problem kind of within the intelligence community, especially as they interact with the military, where people tend to operate on not on like low side emails, and also oftentimes only hold secret level clearances as opposed to sort of higher level clearances. So it can be a real operational issue, because you have to get the, you have to be able to spread information around. But also it's a real problem for the public. When information is marked confidential, the sort of, I don't know, the beige of classification, right? Like, it's not even gray. It's sort of like, well, we'd rather not talk about it in a particular place. You know, that's information that the public, the public should have access to all information they can up and until it actually meaningfully harms right. national security. You know, and overclassification meaningfully harms the process. To that end, it sounds like the administration sort of, is mulling a proposal now to eliminate confidential as a classification mark altogether. This would eliminate about, I think, 96% of the emails that Clinton shared were marked, or that were later determined to be at the confidential level. So it would sort of,
96% of the stuff that had
that was determined, and so nothing was marked classified. Some stuff was determined to be classified after the fact. Of that, the vast, vast majority of that.
But let me
just say, it would be a terrible, terrible thing if the president obliterated this investigation by getting rid of the classified marking. And whatever the right answer to that question, and I favor, you know, bulk declassification of a lot of stuff, but it should wait until after the investigation is done.
Well, this is a question. Can he do that? I mean, can he retroactively eliminate?
So I don't know that I don't know that the statutes are, I don't think so, right?
Okay.
Because the statutes are sort of about intent to remove the marking at a time.
Right. No. But the point is, if the policy decision that he's going to make were perceived to be a response to this investigation, or worse, an attempt to affect the investigation by taking 96% of the stuff out. And admittedly, it wouldn't do that because you can't change the rules retroactively. That would be a really bad thing. And I think it's the better part of valor for the White House would be to wait here until after Comey and company are done and they announce what they're doing in this investigation. And look, that said, the president is obviously right here. You know, when you have a program, and the drone program is a good example of this, that the president can get up in public and joke about with respect to Justin Bieber, right? The Jonas Brothers, right? He warned the Jonas Brothers in public when they met Malia and Sasha, I have two words to say to you, predator drone. And this was a top secret.
The Jonas Brothers should be so lucky.
You know, code word classified program, right? And, the president is publicly joking about it. And, you know, I think at the time the ACLU filed a brief or made an argument that he had just declassified the program. And they have a point. And there really is, you know, material that is, classified for some formal, maybe legitimate reason, like you don't want to acknowledge that you're operating in Pakistan because of some, you know, understanding that you have with the Pakistani military, or more explicitly with the Yemeni government. But that said, it's not really a secret. And there's a real difference between that sort of material and material that is actively closely held that the president would never joke about with the Jonas Brothers in public. And by the way, there's also a difference, and you know, I think people should focus on this more in the Hillary Clinton matter than they do. There's a difference between receiving it, being the passive recipient of somebody sending you right. something where the offense would not be on your part. If somebody sends you something that's not marked as classified, that doesn't seem sensitive, I think you're probably entitled as a matter of trust in your people to assume that that's not classified. There's also a difference when you receive material, or transmit classified material, even actual classified material. The statute does require that you act knowingly. And if you don't know it's classified and you're not doing it maliciously or, the statute as a criminal matter does not punish innocent mistakes.
You know, it's a bit of a tangent, but as in covering the email story, I think that if there actually is a case that investigators are trying to make, and I'm not entirely persuaded that there is, it's not the did you send or receive classified information. It's did you negligently set up a system in which you would have had reason to believe that classified information could have ended up in a non-secure environment.
Right. So, I mean, I think there's lots of, I don't know of a single case that has been prosecuted federally, that has been prosecuted as opposed to dealt with administratively, in which the fundamental argument is the government's belief is that there was negligence. There are cases where that's been the defense. There wasn't anything malicious here. There was just carelessness. But the government does not prosecute cases where it thinks somebody was just being careless.
But actually, this sort of question of can you be careless, or, you know, the even ability to be negligent or the risk of negligence, I think speaks to the need to eliminate things like confidential. Because whenever you have a system in which what is protected is that information, which obviously needs to be protected, I think you reduce some of the confusion, right? Because whenever there is sort of this area of confusion where you're not quite sure, you know, what is classified or what isn't classified, or also, you know, frankly, the fact that senior officials in the United States government or in the United States military get a different set of rules than were junior members. I have to say, you know, we did a book party with General Hayden, where he discussed Shane did not attend.
I don't know
who that is. It was really a remarkable interview, and I thought he gave all kinds of insights, both that were contained in his book and also sort of just insights sort of about his experience, a lot of which were things that I would never dream of discussing in public. I mean, even things that aren't all that interesting, yeah. Continuity of operations plans, things like that, that I just, it wouldn't occur to me to open my mouth because I think I would get in a lot of trouble for doing so. And so I think there's a lot of things going on here, right? There's this sphere of information that is it classified, is it not classified? There's some sense of, well, some people are allowed to talk about some stuff, but that doesn't mean everybody.
Right.
There's these leakers. And so we now have this system in which instead of what we actually need are clear rules where what is protected, what needs to be protected is robustly protected. We have this kind of mishmash world in which I do think that somebody could negligently make a pretty serious mistake, actually.
So I agree with that. And I think the argument for being very rigorous with yourself, does this need to be protected? If it does need to be protected, protect it seriously. And if it doesn't need to be protected, don't even try, is the right way to do it. Here's the problem, I think, with eliminating the confidential category. You might cause a great deal more material to be classified at the secret level. Because somebody then, if they look at the piece of information, and now their choice isn't to, they don't have FOUO, or maybe.
Well, no, they would still have FOUO.
So you still have FOUO.
Which is unclassified for official use only. So that's a marking that if something is not classified, but you are not permitted to share it outside the government.
Right. Although there's no sanction, criminally for doing so. So somebody then has to decide, is it classified or is it not? And they're going to say, Yes, because the same incentive structures still apply. It's an incentive structure in which you don't want to make a mistake. And now you no longer have the confidential file option, so you use the secret option. And so my concern is you might get a much larger amount of information classified at a higher level.
But couldn't you also though prevent that by, in the guidance that would, of course, be issued with this change, essentially the DNI or whomever could say, and by the way, no, this is not permission to just move everything that was once considered confidential up a notch in the ladder into secret. These are the criteria for secret information.
I am certain such guidance will be given.
And be totally ignored.
And I'm equally certain that such guidance will be given the deference it is entitled to, which is to say taken into the bathroom and used as toilet paper.
Right, but okay, so certainly some... So certainly the move to eliminate confidential would not result in removing confidential, just declassifying everything that's currently in the confidential bucket or would be, right? There's going to be some information that will get moved up, hopefully sort of a relatively small subset of that information. That said, there is a use case for this. The Brits, actually, the UK, eliminated their confidential marking about 2 years ago. So maybe they will share their... the lessons learned from their transition.
By the way, best single anecdote in Hayden's book is the account of his call to GCHQ about continuity. If anything happens to NSA, you guys...
You're in charge.
You're in charge of American signals intelligence. I think that is actually the most remarkable revelation in the entire book, that we, after 9/11, told the Brits they get our SIGINT operations if anything happens to Fort Meade. They're in charge of it.
They're the backup.
Yeah.
Thanks,
the
mates.
B team.
Well, they're going to rule Britannia. I think,
war with those people, and now
like
we're like,
button
we're
you just
fun.
Click, it's like transfer.
Yeah.
It just kind of goes over
just
there.
Like just upload.
It's a flag, right? It's like the exactly. Union Jack.
Initiating sync.
Anyway, it made me feel really good.
All the
about
spelling
it.
Changes and everything.
Yeah, exactly.
All the S's,
all these
Z's move to S's.
Get inserted.
It made me feel so good about the special relationship that we'd actually...
It is a special relationship.
It is. I love the Brits.
There's a schedule to take care of these things. okay, let's move on to our third wordplay. This was a terrific and terrifying story, Infusion, by Cashmere Hill, who's a terrific reporter on all things technological, surveillance, and privacy. So in the middle of Kansas, actually... In practically the dead geographic center.
2 hours from the geographic
the
center
States,
of the United States of America?
On a small town owned by the Vogelman family, now a woman by the name of Taylor owns it, is basically a such a little kind of internet hell. Susan, you can elaborate on this, but essentially what's happening here is that thousands and thousands of IP addresses.
Oh, no, 600 million IP addresses.
600 million IP addresses that cannot be tied to a geographic place are defaulting to this one farm in Kansas because of this glitch in a mapping company's
right,
system.
So it's actually not quite a glitch. So I agree, this is really
it's a feature, not a bug.
It's a feature. right. So this is a really remarkable example of sort of great digital investigative journalism, and one that actually I think will have a positive impact on these people's
yes,
lives, and is a great argument for thoughtful design. But essentially, internet protocol addresses are the way two computers speak to one another. In recent years, a number of companies have emerged to provide what they call IP intelligence. And so this is mapping the IP address to a physical location. So sort of at its most precise, you can map an IP address to a house, you can map it to a block, to a zip code, and sort of at its loosest, you can map it to a country. And so there are these... these levels of precision. So there is this company, I think it's called MaxMind, that offers this this digital mapping service. And so whenever they get an IP address that they can't figure out anything more about than what country it is, what they do is they default to a location. They set the sort of this default location of where it is. And so what they did was they picked this default location in the middle of the United States of America.
The actual middle.
Right.
The dead center.
Which happens to be these poor people's farm. And so, like,
they've been raided
by the FBI. What do you mean? They don't know?
Like, the mapping company, if they can't get anything useful, if they can't give the client anything useful, why don't they just say, we don't know where that IP address is?
Well, because they do have a sense that it's in the United States.
Right, they know that it's in the United States.
Somewhere in the United States. We can't give you any...
Why do they have a feeling they may start doing a particular address?
Actually, they've agreed to change their policy to put these default locations, because there are a number in the middle of bodies of water, and so that they don't infect... Because this is not just this one family. This happens to all kinds of people.
So wait, what's happened to this poor family?
So this poor family, they've been raided by the FBI. Ambulance visit them because they think people are committing
Did they get a call from a suicide hotline and it falls there? Somebody left a broken, dirty toilet in their driveway for unknown reasons. They get harassed.
Right. You know, threatened that they're violating intellectual property. All of these people online, their address is all over the internet of these sort of digital detectives that, you know, have searched out, people who've left mean comments on their website or engaged in cyber crimes and all this other stuff. And it's because, whenever they go to look up this IP address, they see this house and they think, all right, this is the IP address. It's in that house. Done. And actually, what's interesting is not just sort of the amateur detectives on the internet, but it apparently is fooling actual detectives, right? So the FBI is actually responding, to a series of calls. And there are a number of stories, that are not just this farm. It's also, an individual, in Ashburn, Virginia,
yeah,
somewhere like that,
Georgia,
who happens to live near a data center. And so the FBI raided his house because they thought that a government laptop was inside. I think there are 17 million IP addresses associated with his house. And so it does call into question, we use the existence of IP address evidence in criminal prosecutions all the time. Is this sort of so exceptional that we don't really need to be concerned about it? Or is this a real reason to say we need to rethink our confidence in what internet protocol and digital information in general, what they can tell us about sort of the real world?
Well, so there's a number of additional elements of this. So one is that, first of all, Cody and a couple of other people and I have been doing this study of sextortion, these online sexual extortions. And we've been looking at 80 or 90 cases of this, all of which require some degree of IP mapping to resolve. And so, if you imagine that more and more people's IP addresses are not physically locatable and all default to a few locations, that's actually a very, very challenging idea from the point of view of a lot of different categories of federal investigations and other investigations. Secondly, as is discussed in David Criss's recent paper, which is published by Hoover but available on Lawfare, the amount of IP address masking going on through the uses of virtual private networks is skyrocketing right now. And that has very big implications, not just for people in Kansas to whom it's going to default to, but also, to the ability of entities like law enforcement and NSA to know the locations of the people that they are conducting surveillance against. A lot of law depends on whether people are domestic or foreign, or local or not. And you could really imagine a world in which location was very hard to discern being at least as challenging a problem as the going dark issues that the FBI is now concerned about.
Right. And I thought one of the really sort of interesting insights in this piece was, Hill writes that one of the problems here is that IP addresses are being used for a purpose that they weren't originally designed for.
Yeah, the company that said this, we never intended for this to be like find things in a house, but she says, yeah, but that's what people use it for.
Exactly. And I think she makes a really excellent analogy. She said it's a little bit like Social Security numbers. Social Security numbers were designed to track your wages over your lifetime. They were not right. designed to sort of be this proof of identity token.
No,
that
but
we
the
use
Estonian
now.
Digital residency is designed for that.
Oh, Lord. They probably don't have this problem in Estonia.
They don't.
It's not a very big country.
It's a very
you know,
small
I'm sure
country.
It's probably easy to just ask somebody if they've seen your phone. They could probably find it for you.
Just look around. Can you look under the cushion?
Oh, I saw it. Yeah, I saw it here. Wow, great story. And props to Kashmir Hill for doing some like serious like public advocacy journalism.
Yeah, I just thought it was a really neat piece.
Yeah, I think the company's actually going to try and fix this now, and these people will have some peace.
I still don't understand why they need, when the answer is, we don't know. Why they need a geographic location, whether in the middle of a body of water or anywhere else,
just
to represent we don't know. Why don't they just say, we don't know, we can't locate that IP address in physical space?
Maximine, you should sponsor our podcast because we're solving your problems.
Yeah.
We're pointing them out. We're not actually solving them. We're just...
Okay, that's fine. We're good at that. Too.
Hey,
speaking of
sponsoring podcasts, I noticed the other day, listening to Radiolab, that MailChimp had given a challenge grant to Radiolab, if they could get a certain number of sustaining members, MailChimp was going to kick in $25,000. I just want to say to MailChimp, what about Rational Security?
Yeah, what about us? We use MailChimp.
Well, Lawfare uses MailChimp, and we should, we want that challenge grant too. So I'm issuing a challenge grant
to your
MailChimp.
Challenge grant.
We challenge us to get
exactly.
money. Yeah, we'll take that challenge.
Please just write us a check.
Just give us money, please.
Yeah.
We need a lot of money. Okay, so we want object lessons. I actually have two this week. One is I'm going to log roll for another podcast.
Oh, why?
Just kidding.
You may be listening to this podcast, and you certainly know National Public Radio, but for listeners for our podcast, if you're not listening to the NPR Politics podcast.
It's a good podcast.
It's an excellent podcast. And I think it's got great people on it. Sam Sanders, my buddy Sue Davis, who covers Congress for NPR. If you like the way that we informally discuss national security and talk the way that we actually do in our normal lives, that's how they talk on this podcast. Check it out. It's very good, particularly if you, too, are obsessed and terrified by the idea of a commander-in-chief Trump. There's a lot of Trump talk these days. You know, Slate, by the way, has a Trump cast devoted just to Donald Trump.
Oh, God.
It's quite delightful. It makes no appearance whatsoever of being impartial, and I just think it's delightful. But my actual object is a new book, which I have a copy of here. Not available in stores yet. Missing Man by Barry Meyer of the New York Times. This is the story of Robert Levinson. Mm-hmm. The retired FBI agent who was working on a contract for the CIA was kidnapped, whereabouts still unknown, although he's believed to be held in Iran. Many people think he's dead. But this purports to be, and I've started reading it, and it's really good so far, sort of the narrative of Bob Levinson and what happened. It looks like Barry just got a lot of great access and dug really deeply into this story, so... pre-order a copy. Biography, true crime, if you're a fan of that, and following the Levinson case, check out Missing Man.
Excellent.
Ben, do you have an object?
I do. My object lesson is a very amusing New York Times editorial yesterday that complained or strongly urged the European Union to follow the U.S. lead in intelligence reform after 9/11 in response to terrorist attacks. Europe could take a page from America's experience, the New York Times wrote. After 9/11, Congress created an independent commission to investigate how al-Qaeda carried out the attacks. And that effort led to many reforms in government structure, regulations, and spycraft. The system isn't perfect, but there have been big improvements, etc. Lisa Monaco, the top White House counterterrorism official, put the matter well in a speech last month. Europe, she said, must do more, quote, to disrupt plots by continuing to break down barriers to increase cooperation and intelligence sharing among agencies, and to do so consistent with the rule of law. So I was really interested in this editorial because I can't recall seeing any editorials by the New York Times that did anything other than object to efforts to break
down... They're on board now.
Break down walls between intelligence and law enforcement, increase information sharing. And I was interested that basically the New York Times is urging Europe to do everything it objected to in the United States, and doing so apparently without irony. Here's to the New York Times wishing on Europe our own pain.
Has Jim Bennett started there yet?
I don't know.
Maybe if you
I don't
guys,
know.
This is the beginning.
Maybe they've just seen the lights.
Yeah, you know, I
think somebody on the way out.
So I think if it would be good for. It would be very good for James Bennett to change the editorial direction of the New York Times editorial page. But if this is him, he should do so with a little bit more cognizance of where the paper has been in the past.
All right. Susan?
My object lesson is a tweet from Jamil Jaffer of the ACLU.
Wait, which one? Okay.
So which one? So this is Jamil Jaffer, not of the ACLU, J-A-M-I-L Jaffer. So Jamil Jaffer of the ACLU, obviously on one side of the national security sort of political policy spectrum. Jamil Jaffer, I believe it's Jamil N. Jaffer.
Correct.
Former Bush administration official, decidedly on the other end of the national security policy spectrum. But there are, in fact, two Jamil Jaffers in sort of the national security space. And so Jamil Jaffer retweeted someone who had directed people. Jamil D. Jaffer had written a piece in the New York Times, an op-ed criticizing Apple's position in Apple versus FBI. And Jamil Jaffer of the ACLU had written, "Not me!" exclamation point, and was directing people to the other. So I offered on Twitter, and I will offer here, my sneaky trick for sussing out, you know, in the national security world, it's not always easy to define people's politics, right? This can be sort of a confusing space. So if you want to find out someone's sort of national security policy orientation, all you say is the good Jamil Jaffer or the bad Jamil Jaffer, and then you see who they refer to.
Ooh, that's a clever trick.
And then you know. And so that is my object lesson.
Which side they're on.
Exactly.
Well, so
who is the good Jamil Jaffer?
So, you know, I have a bit of a history with this issue. The non-ACLU Jamil Jaffer approached me a while back with the idea that what the world really needed was a Jamil Jaffer v. Jamil Jaffer debate.
I totally endorse this.
And asked if we would be interested in hosting, you know.
And it could be Jamil to Jamil, and
yeah,
it would be
exactly.
Like a two.
And, you know, and we've never managed to put it together largely, I think, because ACLU Jamil Jaffer has, I think, limited interest in this idea. But I always thought it was kind of a great idea. You could have, it would even be a good television show, Jamil mm-hmm. v. Jamil, kind of like Hannity and Combs. Yeah, I think it's a two national security lawyers with more or less exactly the same name. From very different sides of the spectrum.
And the two Scott Shanes both recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that was very cute about both being Scott Shane.
There are two Scott Shanes.
One Scott Shane is national security reporter Scott Shane. The other is a business professor who also happens to write for the New York Times. So there are actually two Scott Shanes of the New York Times.
So they actually are this very cute. People confuse me with Scott Shane.
Well, there you go. You should have gotten in on their byline of the two Scott Shanes.
For Scott Shane, which I promptly wrote back to the sender and was like, "You didn't mean to send this to me."
I mean, it'd be interesting.
But
to
I'd
see,
be happy to hear your story.
It would be interesting to see how many, like, if we could say Scott Shane Harris, could we, like, Sir Walter Scott Shane
yeah.
Harris?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how many names could we line up?
I'm probably related to most of them.
This is a good game. Well, let's monetize this somehow.
Please, we need stuff. We need to do something.
Without MailChimp's help.
Yeah, it's coming down to this. All right, that brings us to the end of the podcast. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find links to our past shows and our other productions at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. You can follow us on Twitter at RATLSecurity. Please, when you download the podcast, or if you've already subscribed, go back, leave a review, leave comments. It really helps us out and helps other people find this terrific, totally impoverished show. The podcast is edited, as always, by Jen Howell. Our music was performed this week by Liz Tom and the Doo-Wop Doppelgangers.
Excellent.
All right, not bad.
All right,
not
I didn't bad. Look up. Oh, yeah, it was good.
That's good.
All right,
it's good.
Okay, good. That's cute.
It's cute.
It's or maybe
a,
just
it's
Liz
nice
Tom
song.
And the Liz Tom and the Doppelgangers.
Mm-hmm.
The Doo-Wop-Gangers.
That's a whole new genre we've invented. No, of course, you know who performs our music as always, Sophia Yan. Thank you, Sophia. On behalf of my good friends Ben Wittes and Susan Hennessy, I'm Shane Harris, and thanks to Liz Tom. We'll talk to you next week.